The Chris Perillo Show is brought to you by Microsoft Windows Media. Download Windows Media Player 10 at Microsoft.com/Windows Media. Give us feedback on this podcast or ask tech questions by calling the voicemail hotline at 877-414-5856. That's 877-414-5856 to get your questions answered.
Yes, I'm looking for Dr. Phil.
Oh, yeah, you just need to straighten your life up.
Is that your best Southern accent?
No, he's not really Southern. He's sort of a Texas obnoxious, isn't he?
Is that different from Southern, then?
I don't know. When I lived in Texas for a summer, and they used to make fun of me. And I said, I'm from Virginia. And they said, oh, then you're from back east. I thought, great, I can't win.
So you all was forgiven as soon as you said Virginia?
Unfortunately, no. I think it made it worse.
It's usually the way it goes. Well, when it comes to the stars, it doesn't matter where you're from. Well, unless,
hey,
of course, it's like geolocated, you know, specifically the stars in that range of the sky's area of the other mathematically speaking terms.
Well, now you're just confusing me.
Well, that's my job.
How do I sound here?
You sound fine.
Okay, I'm wearing a headset.
So can I call you Dr. Phil?
You can. You probably shouldn't, though.
Yeah, well, but is it true?
You get copyright infringement.
Oh, really? So there's no other Dr. Phils on the planet now?
I hate that guy, too.
Why? Have you ever really listened to his advice?
Yeah, he's basically telling people they're stupid and to get a life.
But you do the same thing.
No, I don't tell people they're stupid. I tell them they're being misled.
Oh, okay. So there's a difference. There's a big difference between saying you're being misled and you're stupid.
Well, yeah. Maybe we should save this for the interview, but aren't you recording already?
Oh, I've been recording.
Oh, great. Perfect. Okay. I did not have sex with that woman. Okay.
Dr. Phil? He's not a woman.
I got that online.
Yeah.
No, I make a big point of that. Look, it's easy to get fooled by people. It's really, you don't have to be stupid to get fooled. That's something that James Randi talks about, the skeptic. He says scientists are his favorite audience for doing magic tricks because they think they're so smart. And they say, oh, I know just how this is going to work. And then they can't figure it out. And it's really easy for him to fool them all the time. It's really funny.
So do a lot of astronomers fool people? Or are they just, you know, the straight people?
Oh, I like to think that, you know, astronomers are trying to do their best to tell the truth. It's not always true. But, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of person you are at work. There's always going to be a handful of people who are going to use what they know for nefarious purposes.
And what makes you an authority on this?
Ooh, authority. I don't like that word.
you don't believe it. Anarchy!
Yeah, that's right. Listen to me. Obey. Consume. No, it's not like that. I mean, the word authority just is like somebody you're not supposed to question. I'm in a position of authority over you. I order you around. Expert might be a better word, because an expert is just somebody who's thoroughly versed and well-read and knows what they're doing. But when you say to somebody else, why, I'm an expert on that. It's synonymous with, why, I'm a pretentious, arrogant jerk about this topic. And so I don't like using that one either. I just like to say, well, you know, I have been studying this for a few years, and I've seen what's going on, and I do have some insight into it. And, of course, by the time you say all that, people are falling asleep, and they're looking to see what else is on the radio. So I'm not going to go into that.
So what word do you use, then, to describe yourself? So if it's bad
perfection,
astronomy?
Would that be a good one? No.
Could you use good astronomer?
Sure.
Yeah.
Expert is fine. I mean, if somebody else calls me an expert, I wouldn't argue it. Because, you know, by definition, well, yeah, I mean, I know a lot about, you know, the moon landings and astrology and that kind of stuff. So maybe
But we didn't land on the moon. I don't know if you caught the webpage that's out there, but it claims, and it's got some pretty good evidence, that we didn't actually go to the moon.
Well, I didn't go.
I know you didn't go, but I mean, like Neil Armstrong and Buzz
Aldrin.
They never
saw you there.
Well, yeah, but we didn't go. This is what the photos say, so it must be true.
Yes, I'm going to announce it here on the Chris Perillo Show. We didn't go to the moon. It's all been a giant hoax.
See?
And I collect paychecks from NASA, and I am a hired goon, and NSA and CIA pays me under the table.
Must be nice.
Which is why I live in a huge mansion with my enormous office, and I've been accused of all this stuff in the past. It cracks me up.
With a 12-inch telescope.
I do, in fact, have a 12-inch telescope.
Yes.
And it was, in fact, given to me. But that's different.
Was it was it from an astronaut who gave it to you, or
no? It was actually a fan.
Wow!
I had
must have been one hell of a fan.
Let's just drop the whole moon hoax thing now. moving on.
Oh, we'll get back to it. Don't worry about that.
No, I was doing a podcast called Skepticality, which is a popular critical thinking podcast, and I happened to mention that I didn't have a telescope anymore. I had one, but when I moved out west, I basically sold it for a song to a friend of mine so that his daughter could use it, and I just didn't want to move it. So I bought myself a pair of binoculars, and I've been happy with that. And a guy who lives not too far from me said, I have a telescope that's collecting dust. I'll give it to you. And I said, no, don't be silly. Yeah, right. I said, oh, I'd be happy to take that. And so he gave it to me, and it's a nice telescope. It's a 12.5-inch. It's pretty big, and it's heavy. It's really easy to use, but it's heavy. So I'm going to put wheels on it, and that'll make it easier for me to roll it out into my backyard.
So now you can use that to view the moon and where we didn't land, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you could, well, no. See, when you phrase things like that,
well,
I can use
job.
To look at the moon, and I can see the landing sites, but it doesn't matter. I mean, this is one of those things that these moon hoax people always say, just show me a picture from Hubble of the Apollo 12 flag or something like that. But you can't. If you work out the numbers, and this always shocks people, you can sit down and work out the math and show that the smallest thing that Hubble, even Hubble, can see on the moon is about the size of a football stadium. And most people are shocked by that. They say, oh, we can see all this detail on these distant galaxies. And it's like, well, the detail you're seeing in those distant galaxies is really big. It's still stuff that's light years across. And even though the moon is close, Hubble really can't resolve things that are that small on the moon. We just have to go back, take more pictures.
Well, isn't that the idea? Aren't we supposed to be going back?
Yeah, this is very exciting, although we'll see how NASA's going to work this out, because I still think the plans are not as solid as I'd like to see, but the idea right now is they're building what's called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. This is a probe that'll be launched in 2008, which is in just 2 short years, and it'll orbit the moon and take pictures and do mineralogy. It's actually going to study the moon as a target for exploration. NASA's being very careful, for some reason, to couch this in terms of exploration and not science, the idea being that we're going to put people back on the moon, and therefore it's exploration.
I've got a few ideas. I got a few ideas as far as who we can put back on the moon.
Really, who?
Yeah, well, all the people we don't like.
Well, sure.
So, like, if they screw things up down here, like, we just put them on the moon.
I think that was Hitchhiker's Guide, wasn't it? All of the telephone cleaners and telemarketers who... they stuck on a spaceship and shot them off into space.
Which would be wonderful, wouldn't it?
As long as I get to make the rules.
Yeah. Or, you know, that's something that... you think it's science fiction, but it's really science fact. That a lot of the telemarketers do get blasted off. It doesn't happen here, of course. It's like some secret island in the Caribbean or something.
But they're like bacteria. They reproduce faster than you can get rid of them.
What, bad scientists or telemarketers?
Telemarketers. They'll always be here.
So where did you get the domain, Bad Astronomy?
Solutions.
Yeah, okay, I knew that one was
coming. Thank you, folks.
Okay, let me be a little more specific with that. Where did you come up with the idea of that domain and the content on the site?
It was actually back in 93 when I was still in grad school, and I saw a newscaster doing a news bit about kids standing eggs on end on the first day of spring. And he said, why, yes, the gravity of the Earth and Sun align on this day. And after screaming incoherently at my TV set, I actually sat down and put together a web page debunking this idea that you can only stand eggs on it on the first day of spring. And this is a pretty common legend. Now, this was back in the days of Mosaic. Remember Mosaic?
Oh, yeah.
It's like Pong, you know. It's like, oh, God, it was a million years ago. And if I got, 10 hits to my site a year, I was like, woohoo, 10 people saw this. And eventually I just started adding more stuff to it and started doing movie reviews and different things. And then in 98, I bought the domain name because it just seemed natural. There was a bad science website out there, although it wasn't really general science. He did weather. He talks about raindrops aren't teardrop-shaped and things like that, little things that are just kind of fun to read about. And I said, hey, I could do Bad Astronomy. That's a good name. And I took it and haven't really looked back since.
So there's a lot of myths going on out there.
Oh, yeah. More than I possibly have time to write about.
So do you talk about them? All the
time. Sometimes even on the radio.
Well, that's kind of scary, you know, when you talk about it. Well, I realize I have to ask the question correctly, otherwise I get a completely different answer. From you, that is. Because you take things so literally, you know, being a scientist and all. Allegedly a scientist. I don't know. You haven't proven anything. You know, you haven't scanned your documents onto your website or anything.
Oh, yes, I have.
Oh, you have?
My PhD thesis is actually online, and I have a link to it someplace on my website.
You can't
say,
Phil, you can't say thesis on the radio.
I can't?
No, it's...
How about endangered thesis?
Okay, that's better.
Can I fling thesis?
Only if you're a certified simian.
Okay. Where were we?
You scan the documents to prove you are who you are.
I have some papers that you can find online. I actually haven't published that many research papers. After I got my degree, I worked on a couple of different NASA I worked on one NASA satellite for a few months, and then that never had any published papers. Then I moved on to Hubble. You may have heard of that. And but I was sort of a glorified flunky. I wasn't doing my own real research. I was helping other people with their research. So my name's on like two dozen papers as 17th author. But it allowed me to do a lot of really interesting stuff. And I got to see how to do projects that I normally wouldn't have been involved with, like star formation and asteroids and black holes and galaxies and all kinds of different stuff. It was really a lot of fun. But as far as, you know, research papers that I've done, there are only three or four where I'm first author, and you can find them. And they're terribly, terribly fascinating to literally, you know, ones of people.
Have you ever been debunked? Really?
That's a good question. Yeah. Chris, I'm proud of you.
What do you mean you're proud of me? I'm going off the blue cards that the producer handed me.
Excellent. I was, in fact, debunked. I was tearing apart. I mean, I make mistakes. I'm just this guy. I'm sitting around in my office in my PJs drinking root beer and looking stuff up. And
there's a visual.
Yeah, sorry about that, folks. And I was talking about the moon hoax, and I was talking about how these guys are claiming that on the moon, the shadows of the astronauts should be pitch black, and yet in many cases, you can see details in the shadow. You can see, for example, the American flag on the spacesuit and different things like that. And I said, well, the sun isn't the only source of light. In fact, the Earth was up in the sky, and that was acting as a light which could fill in these shadows and illuminate stuff in the shadows. And it turns out that's totally wrong, and somebody actually put up a website saying, no, the Earth isn't bright enough to do it, and there are some sites who claim it's the Earth, but it's wrong, and they were talking about me. And the irony here is that the guy who posted this was Richard Hoagland.
Really?
You've heard of him.
Yeah, no, I've met him.
Really?
Yeah, the Enterprise Project?
Yeah, the Enterprise Mission. Yeah.
A mission, that's it.
This is the Face on Mars guy, the guy who's been saying that somebody built a two-mile-wide, you know, human-like face on Mars, and he makes all these claims. 99.999% of the stuff he says is absolute crap, and I've got a webpage debunking him, too. But he does occasionally hit the mark, and he was absolutely right. I was wrong, and I corrected my page.
I remember watching one of his videos where he was talking about these alleged structures on the moon when photos were taken, and there's allegedly, like, lines in the background somehow.
Yeah.
So what was that about?
Here's a guy who spends, you know, 24 hours a day coming up with incredible nonsense to fool people with. And, you know, he may be doing this because, you know, he's totally honest. He really believes this stuff. I don't know. But you can imagine you spend all your time saying NASA's lying, NASA's hiding material from you, the astronauts saw all this stuff on the moon. He claims the astronauts saw, you know, mile-high crystal structures and buildings and all kinds of stuff. And then it comes along the moon hoax, where people saying that NASA faked the astronauts going to the moon. He finds himself in the very difficult and delicate position of having to defend NASA, because if the moon landings are faked, then the astronauts were never on the moon, and if the astronauts were never on the moon, he can't tell people that they saw mile-high crystal structures on the moon. So he had to write a page defending NASA, which gives me no end of glee and delight. But that's what he's saying, and it's really funny, because one of his pictures where he talks about this giant structure on the moon, I looked at it, and I knew instantly what it was. It's sort of an overexposed internal reflection in the camera. You can see this in the picture, that it's the same shape as the iris inside of a camera, you know, the little aperture inside that lets in light, or you know, you You make it smaller to let in less light, and you open it up to let in more light, just like the pupil in your eye. And it's got the same shape and everything, so it's very clear that this quote-unquote structure on the moon is just the way the light was entering the camera. And so, you know, this is sort of the limit of the amount of reasoning that he applies to his argument.
So he's wrong.
Yes, in a word.
In a word?
I can always make a short story long. You can just say he's wrong, or I can give you a 20-minute diatribe saying, you know, about all the mathematics and statistics that he uses and abuses, but maybe just saying he's wrong is better.
He's also got, what is it, it's like something to do with a pyramid, not an actual physical pyramid, but like he says that on certain points on Earth, there are important things happening, like vortices.
Yes.
And I can't remember what it's called. It's something scientific.
It's the hyperdimensional physics.
That would be it.
That's it. He loves to toss around stuff like this.
But is it hyperdimensional bullcrap?
I wouldn't phrase it just like that, but since, you know, the FCC might come down on me, I'll just leave it at that. But you have indeed put your finger on the steaming pile of excrement that would be the arguments used. It's really funny. What he's doing is he's picking and choosing his data. It's very easy to, after the fact, find lots of coincidences in numbers if you ignore 99% of the numbers. In other words, he says there's this one angle that NASA likes to launch rockets at. I think it's 19.5 degrees. And he picks this number, and then he goes looking for it in all the data. And sometimes, you know, he says, well, here's a star that was 19.5 degrees off the horizon when NASA launched the space shuttle. It's like, well, yeah, but there were lots of stars at 19.5 degrees, and there were lots of stars that weren't at 19.5 degrees. And so he's just picking that number out of all the data when there are all these other numbers he's not telling you about. So it looks like it's really remarkable. Really, it's just numerology. It's just ridiculous. It's choosing things beforehand and then only showing you that afterhand, and it's not fair. It's not reasonable.
Now, why is this dangerous? Because, I mean, I've listened to the guy. It sounds interesting. He's a little charismatic. But why is it bad?
Why is it bad? There are a lot of reasons. One is that people pay for this. People use their hard-earned money, and then they go to they're going to a UFO convention or something. They'll pay $45 to sit through a six-hour lecture by him, and he's making money off them. Now, look, you know, caveat emptor, right? If you're making money and you're going to spend it on this kind of stuff, I'm not going to stop you. But what is really happening here is that this sort of stuff, this moon hoax stuff, the face on Mars stuff, all of this is eroding our ability to think. These guys...
Wait. I thought television was eroding our ability to think.
Well, certainly as a medium it is, but there's got to be a message. And, you know, there's a lot of good television out there. I was watching the Science Channel last night. They had a TV show about comets and another one about Pluto, and it was awesome. It was really cool. It was good stuff. But then you can go and watch shows about ghosts and UFOs and all kinds of nonsense.
And Laverne and Shirley. I mean, what's up with that?
Hey, look, don't be making fun of Laverne and Shirley. Michael McKean is a genius.
You know, I agree, but...
Although I can't understand a word Peggy Marshall says anymore. Have you seen her on Celebrity Poker?
No, I don't.
Imagine playing poker against her, and you're like, how much did she just raise me? I have no clue. I don't know. But anyway.
Speaking of bad, no. So
the
issue at hand is we have people out there who believe they're correct, and they may or may not be correct.
Or they may be lying vicious. You know, hoaxers. We don't know.
But how do you know that? I mean,
you don't know.
You know, if let's say, I mean, random X guy decides that he's going to claim that something is happening. If it's not in popular opinion, does that necessarily mean that it's wrong?
Okay, let me be clear. There are people out there who are absolutely sincere in their beliefs, and they are very wrong. You know, there are people out there who say the moon landings are faked, and they... It's clear that they believe that the moon landings are fake, but they're impervious to evidence. I can show them all the evidence that they're wrong, and they won't believe me. These are people who are just deluded, I guess, for lack of a better word. There are almost certainly people out there who are lying to you. They know perfectly well that what they're saying is garbage, but they're saying it anyway because they want the attention or they're making money or whatever. I don't necessarily have evidence that any one person is on either side of this. You know, I could name names here and say this person is either a liar or is deluded. I don't know. And I do know that some of these people have, in fact, lied. I've got evidence that they've lied. I've got evidence that you can show them where they're wrong. They agree that they must be wrong. And then a month later, they're using that same argument. So clearly they're lying. I don't know. I don't care. You know, that's up to the authorities. If I can prove that Richard Hoagland's a fraud, then I would, but I don't care. The point is that he's wrong. So if he's lying, or whether he's just, I guess, religious in his beliefs about this, doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is that what he's saying is wrong. I can show that he's wrong. And if people read what I'm writing, they don't even have to believe me. They just have to think for themselves. I'm not telling them, here's why he's wrong or anything like that. It's specifically, it's more of a general thing. Apply logic. Look at all the facts. Look at all the evidence. Use a little bit of math if you need to. But you can see that what these guys are saying is just ridiculous. It's wrong.
Do you find yourself debunking things every day?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That much bad stuff out there.
But it depends. I mean, it's not just astronomy.
Wait. So you've branched out into what, Beanie Babies now? Because apparently they're popular items.
You know that they're laced with LSD on the little tag. That's why
I knew it.
The tag off.
I knew it. I knew there was a reason for addiction.
It's true. I was wondering about the Timothy Leary one. So it seemed funny in my head.
Okay. Yeah, I know that joke dates you. You realize that's not exactly
Does it really? Well, I mean, but who's famous who does LSD? You see, there you go.
Yeah, I guess I missed that one.
All right.
George Bush.
Was there evidence he did LSD?
I can find some, and then you can debunk me.
Excellent.
Yes. So what else do you debunk then? Besides,
this brings us to an interesting point.
Really? Did it really? Or?
Amazingly enough.
Did we come full circle
shotgun,
on something there?
One of the pellets is going to land on a good spot. It's not just astronomy. Sure, I debunk astronomy. That's bad astronomy, and maybe other things too, like. Intelligent design that may not necessarily cover astronomy.
Now, wait. When they say intelligent design, are they saying extraterrestrial or, God?
Well, that's okay.
Because seriously, if someone says intelligent design, the first thing in my head is, oh, it must be another intelligent form of life in the universe that, has been around. That is not something theoretical, something that we feel, something tied to emotion, something based on faith that would be a higher power. So which one is it?
This interview is the conversational equivalent of a bumper card ride at the circus.
Thank you.
Intelligent design proponents are typically very coy about who they say the intelligent designer is. They say, oh, no, we don't necessarily mean God. It could be aliens. It could be this. It could be that. And that's what they say in public. But in private, they're very clear that they mean not just God, but they mean the Old Testament Bible God, the literal interpretation of the Bible God. This is, in fact, one of the major reasons that the judge in Dover, Pennsylvania, overthrew the teaching of intelligent design in the classroom. He said, first of all, it's not science. Second of all, it's religion. And when the intelligent designers say, oh, we're not saying it's religion, and he said, you guys are liars. And he used the word liars, I believe. He said that in private, they're very clear they mean God. And in public and in court, under oath, they were coy about it. And he said, that's not right. You guys can't do that. And I wrote about that on my blog, saying, look, you can't get away with this. These guys are clearly trying to be deceptive about this.
So that's bad science, intelligent design?
Or intelligent design is terrible science.
Why?
Well, first of all, it's not science. It could almost be science if they could make predictions. The problem is they don't. All they say is, we see evidence in biology of mechanisms which could not have evolved. And they give examples. The
carrot top.
Eye, flagellum on a bacterium, little hairs around a bacterium. And they say this could not possibly have evolved. And it turns out their logic is flawed. I'll leave that to the evolutionary biologists, but they can show this. That, in fact, these things can evolve. We do understand how the eye evolved fairly well, how the little hairs on bacteria evolved. So that's not science in that it's not predictive. They're not making a prediction. They're just saying we see evidence that evolution is wrong. That's not science. They don't have their own science unless they were to say, here is a prediction that we can make that we will see, X. If we think evolution doesn't work, then X. But they never say that. All they do is they pick apart evolution. And so that in itself is not a science. The other problem is that it is religion. Intelligent design is religion. That's what the judge pointed out. And therefore, it's unconstitutional to teach it in school. The other problem is that it's wrong. These guys claim constantly all of these things about evolution, all these things about math, all these things about science, and their claims are just wrong. All the astronomy claims that I've seen they've been making have been wrong so far, and yet they claim them as truth, and it's very irritating.
Wait,
because they're no better than Hoagland and these moon hoax guys.
What astronomy claims have they made?
Oh, man, there's tons of them. You can go, for example, now, I should say, I'm gonna be clear here, intelligent design is just another form of creationism, that the universe was created by some designer. Whether you want to say that was 6,000 years old, as some literal Bibleists do, or whether it's 6 billion years old, which is called old earth creationism, you know, this is all creationism, and intelligent design falls under that. And creationists have been making claims about astronomy for a long time. They say the Big Bang is wrong, they say relativity is wrong, they say, you know, if the Big Bang were true, how did the Earth form? And you can go and you can search for this stuff. I actually wrote a chapter in my book called Bad Astronomy, available everywhere.
Which I have on my bookshelf, by the way.
Really?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
It's autographed. By you. You gave it to me when we met.
That's right.
What do you mean you're sorry? You're the one who gave it to me.
No, I do remember that, actually. That was a long time ago. And for the listeners here, Chris and I were on a television network, Tech TV. Oh, I'm sorry, something.
No, that's okay. It's now rerun. Instead of, you know, original content, it's rerunning the Man Show now. So,
do they really have the Man Show? Oh, that's right. I saw that the other day. I thought I was watching Comedy Central.
I kid you not.
Yeah, this is the G4 show.
Yeah,
station or whatever they call it. Yeah, it's a little weird.
They've forgotten about their audience. But anyway, so that's where I got the book. So you've got the book,
right.
Bad Astronomy. They make all these astronomical claims, like,
oh, you know, how can you form the solar system? Like, the planet Uranus is tilted by about 90 degrees off of its orbit.
Yeah.
How can that possibly happen?
Yeah, what is
Big
up
Bang,
with that?
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It's like, well, the Big Bang has nothing to do with that. The Big Bang was about 14 billion years ago. The planets, the solar system, formed about 4.5 billion years ago. The universe had been around for 10 billion years before we formed. The Big Bang was long gone by then. Basically, the solar system formed from a flat disk of gas and dust that looked actually quite a bit like a spiral galaxy. Not exactly, but it looked a lot like it. The planets formed from this, and probably when they initially formed, all the planets were not tilted at all. You can think of their spin axis.
Wait a second.
Being straight up and down.
So are you saying that the gas was expelled by Uranus, or?
For the next 10 minutes, just pretend that I'm laughing like that. Oh my God.
Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
Do you know your audience?
I think they know me.
We're talking to? Okay.
Yes,
well, any guy who would rent his chest for $25.
It is just 20.
Is it 20?
Come on. Hey, I'm going to have to debunk you.
Wow, it's a 20% discount, or is that just...
No, it's always been $20.
See, there you go. This
care.
Is the kind of argument they use. You start with a false premise and then say, oh, so you're giving a 20% discount to your listeners. No, it was never $25.
Uh-huh.
You can twist the arguments around and make it seem like the other person put them on the defensive.
So why are these guys doing this? Why are they being nutty, in your opinion? I mean, you're not actually calling them nutty, but, well, in a way you are.
Some of them are nutty. Yeah, I mean, look, some of these people, like I said, you know, if I wanted to make a lot of money, and of course I do, but if I really wanted to make a lot of money, and I told this to my boss many years ago when I was working on Hubble, I said, look, you know, I can make $1 million is roughly how much money I can make over the rest of my life in astronomy, working a 9-to-5 job. That's about right, you know, 40 years at $25,000 a year, 25 years at $40,000, whatever. Call it $1 million. If I were to approach Fox TV and say, I want to make a documentary showing that the moon landings are faked, and I want to be the one who says it, I could ask them for $1 million to do that. And so I can make $1 million overnight doing this. And the fact of the matter is I don't. You know, so that, I think, indicates that I'm honest, or I want to be honest. But clearly there's a lot of money in this. If you know, Hoagland charges a fortune for his seminars, you know, $40 a head, and he'll have 10, 20, 30 people show up. I went to a UFO talk at my own university where I'm at right now. Some guy, they paid him $1,200. He stood up there for an hour and a half and had a slide, honest to God, Kodak slides in a carousel with drawings of flying saucers. Not a single picture of a flying saucer, just drawings. $1,200 this guy made. Plus, they put him in a nice hotel, and he got to stay in the wine country in California for a couple of days. There's money out there to be made in this stuff. You can write books. You can make videos. You can go on TV. You can consult with these ridiculous documentaries and make a lot of cash. I am making a fraction of what I could be making if I were to go over to the dark side. And I don't, because I'm honest. I want the real science, the real truth to be out there. And so a lot of people are doing this to make money. Some of them do it, who knows, for attention. Maybe they just they like having people emailing them and saying, yeah, you're the man. And some of them maybe just really, really honestly believe it. It's like, I'm not trying to denigrate religion, but I mean it's like a religious thing. It's more of a matter of faith. It's not based on evidence. They just believe it no matter what. And so that's just the way their minds work.
Now, Phil, do you just need a hug? I mean, because it sounds like you're just not loved enough. You go out on the defensive all the time. Why? Why don't you be offensive every once in a while?
Am I being defensive?
No, you're not. I'm saying like you're.
Are you being sarcastic?
Yeah, I'm kind of being sarcastic.
I just backed off a little bit. And I think, am I being defensive?
No, I was attempting to. Well, no, it seems that in coming out and having a website, badastronomy.com, the premise is that there's bad astronomy out there. So,
well, yeah,
are
the
you...
whole website is defensive, I guess, in that I'm trying to defend the truth.
Right, but are you doing anything? Beyond just defending, are there things that you're writing about or doing that are less
proactive?
Yeah, proactive, I think, is the right corporate term to use.
Is it high leverage enough, do you think? Free based? I actually do educational stuff, and you have to use all of these hyphenated words, and it cracks me up.
In that ecosystem, yes.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Golly, that's actually a really interesting question. A lot of it is defensive because. This idea will come up that, there's a giant gas cloud that's been expelled by the black hole in the center of our galaxy headed for Earth, and it's going to destroy us all.
Yeah, my dad used to do the same thing on Sunday afternoon.
Tell me about it. But this came out, actually, in the Weekly World News, and then Yahoo.com put it in their news section as straight news. They called it the chaos cloud. They mentioned that it was from the Weekly World News, the same... highly researched tabloid that gave us Bat Boy, Yahoo printed it straight, and so this became a big deal. A lot of people were writing me emails about it, so I put up a page about it, and it became a huge thing. I couldn't believe it. I thought this was just a little stupid thing that I could just debunk, and it's actually one of my most popular pages on my website. So, a lot of this is defensive. It has to come up first before I can debunk it. I used to do real research. I don't do scientific research so much anymore. I do a lot of basic educational stuff. That's my day job at Sonoma State University in California. I actually have grants that pay us to develop educational materials, outreach materials, things for kids to do, to teach them basic science and math. That's actually what I spend most of my time doing. Bad astronomy stuff is sort of my secret identity.
Well, could you find a grant that could support what you're doing with it?
I could. I've thought about it. Getting like a NASA grant or something to develop like an educational activity to teach kids why the moon hoax is garbage, for example, where they would have to sit down and look at the shadows not being parallel and look at the flag waving and try to figure all this stuff out. That's a lot of work. And so I was like, well, maybe not. In fact... my day job keeps me so busy, and doing the bad astronomy stuff keeps me so busy that I don't think I have time to work on something like that. If somebody else did, and they wanted to use me as a consultant, I could do that. And in fact, I'm talking with some people about a planetarium show based on misconceptions and different things like that, that really do use these misconceptions, like standing an egg on end, or why the moon looks bigger on the horizon than overhead, to teach kids sort of basic science. It works really well, actually. Studies have shown that using misconceptions does a really good job.
Okay, so what about Velikovsky? Was he off his rocker or what?
Oh, yeah. So Velikovsky, Emmanuel Velikovsky was this guy, about 70 years ago maybe when he started researching this. I don't know the exact date, but about that. Looked at the Bible, was reading it and said, golly, a lot of the things in the Bible sure sound like they might have really happened. Volcanoes and catastrophes and blood falling from the sky and manna from heaven and all these things. And he said there are similar events in other ancient writings. And he started looking at all these, and he kind of got this idea that maybe, you remember you may remember if you know your mythology, that the Greeks said that Aphrodite, what the Romans called Venus, sprung fully formed from the head of Zeus slash Jupiter, depending on whether you're Greek or Roman, that she was born from his head, just erupted from his head. He said maybe this is literally true. Maybe the planet Venus erupted from Jupiter like a giant comet, swung around the solar system, creating all this kind of havoc, and then eventually settled into its orbit that we see it in today. And he said this would explain things like manna fell from the heaven when the Jews were in Exodus from Israel, and the plague of vermin and all these other things. It would explain a lot of stuff in the Bible. The problem is he was totally 100% completely wrong. It's amazing the breadth and depth of how wrong this theory is, and yet how long it lasted. There are still people out there who try to fit the data to his theories, even though it's clear that this guy is totally full of it. I think he honestly believed what he was saying. I think a lot of these people honestly believe this stuff, but it's just as wrong could be.
How do you know he was wrong?
It just doesn't work. You can't eject a planet from another planet the way he said and have it do all of these things. I actually show this, again, there's a chapter in my book about it. You can find more information online. But, you know, he actually says the vermin from the 10 plagues of Egypt was actually from, these were things that lived on Venus, insects on Venus. And Venus got so close to the Earth that we exchanged atmospheres, that actually the atmosphere of Venus poured onto the Earth, and all of these bugs came with it. Well, the problem is you can work out the math. It's really simple, actually, and say, how close would Venus have to be to the Earth for that to happen? And the answer is our surfaces would have to be a few miles apart. Now, think about this, okay? Earth and Venus are very roughly the same size. They're both about 8,000 miles across. So you've got these planets 8,000 miles across, separated by, you know, 20 miles, 10 miles, 5 miles. They're so close, they're practically touching. Venus would literally fill the sky. It would be like standing on your head and looking at the ground. I mean, Venus would be as big in the sky as the Earth is when you look around. So it would fill the whole sky up. Yet there's no mention of this in the Bible or any ancient writings, that you could see Venus getting bigger and bigger until it filled the sky. And there are other problems. I mean, the gravity from Venus would, and the gravity of the Earth on Venus would rip the two planets apart. And so I hate to sound like one of these guys and say, why, that's impossible. But it's impossible. You just can't do that. And it just doesn't work. I mean, it's far easier to say to yourself, is this a legend, okay? Is this some other phenomenon that happened that over the years of retelling and retelling got distorted, which is a little bit more logical than a giant planet doing all this stuff to us? You have to decide which is easier to swallow.
What, Venus or Earth?
Yes.
Which one do you think is easier to swallow?
I don't know. I used to eat dirt when I was a kid.
So that explains a lot, then.
Actually, I didn't, but I thought that would be the right thing to say. I can't have you give me a straight line and not turn around and say something.
Oh, well, see, I wasn't expecting that. So shifting gears for just a moment, and then we'll get back onto the bumper car
ride.
For
the first time in this conversation, let's shift gears.
Yes,
okay.
Let's go into a different subject, now for something completely different. Telescopes.
Ooh, I've heard of them.
Yeah, I Ponzi had picked up a Meade telescope. I can't remember the exact... LX-125, maybe, what it was? I don't know. I'm going by memory at this point.
I'd have to look it up. There are a lot of different brand names out there.
Yeah, she thought... I mean, I'd always go into the Discovery Channel store and look at the telescopes, kind of like... Oh, sorry. I was going to sigh there.
They give you a lump in your throat? Is that...
Yeah, I think it's long story short. And so she said, well, I'll just get it for him. And so she got a telescope, but it turns out that may not have been the one that I would have wanted in the first place. And I've been going back and forth on, do I go with a Meade? Some people have recommended a Celestron for various reasons. Astrophysicists have sent me literally like Excel spreadsheets of how they analyzed how they were going to go and buy things. I'm like, dear God, if I ever
really
do this, shoot me.
And I thought I was a geek. I feel a lot better now.
No, I mean, someone had sent me this based on, this is the work they do. They do comparisons for a living. And so this is what they did. I'm like, wow, that, it was awfully detailed, and it saved me a lot of time, so I was very, very appreciative. But it gave me a little more insight in terms of what I would be looking for, what I might want, things I had to think about. And I don't know, I was just hoping you could walk us through the neighborhood of buying a telescope or some terminology.
A lot of people approach this. Like a telescope is, well, maybe not a toy, but it's like a TV, you know. You can just look at it and say, well, I want it to be a certain size, and I want it to have a nice picture and nice sound. And then you just, you know, you look up the quality of the brand name and you buy it. But it's not really like buying a TV. It's more like buying a car. You know, you wouldn't buy a car for a friend because they said they need a car. It really depends on what they need that car for. Are they just commuting to work? Are they going to drive up to a ski resort? Are they going to use it to haul garbage? Are they going to, you know, you have a family? What is it you're going to be doing with this? Telescopes are the same way. Some are small, some are big. Some are better for looking at small, bright objects like the planets, which are very small, so you want a lot of magnification. Some are better at looking at bigger objects that are very faint, like gas clouds in space and galaxies and things like that. And so right away you need to understand, what is it I want to look at? Then you have to think to yourself, where am I going to be observing? Am I going to set this thing up permanently in my backyard? Then I don't care if it's heavy or lightweight. Is it something I need to store in my garage and I want to throw in the back of my car so when I go camping, I have it with me? So you want something that's portable. So you've got all these different decisions to make, and it's actually, it's kind of funny. You think it's easy, but it turns out it's not. It's a kind of a tough decision. And so the best thing to do when I tell people about this, the absolute best thing you can do, is find an astronomy club in your area. I can almost guarantee you, unless you live in the middle of really nowhere, and even then, you will probably find an astronomy club nearby. The thing to do is to go visit them. These are, to a man or woman, very friendly, helpful people who will love to show you stuff in the sky and love to show you how a telescope works. So there are places you can find clubs. You could go to the Sky and Telescope website. Sky and Telescope's a really good magazine. And I'm not saying that because I write for them occasionally. I'm saying it because they really are a good magazine. They have a new magazine they've started called Night Sky. And I'll plug that because I write a regular column for that as well called Straight Talk. But Night Sky is designed for people who are beginning in astronomy. Teaches you how to use a telescope, teaches you how to look in the sky, what to look for, what astronomy is. And you can go to the websites for these magazines, skyandtelescope.com. You can find a list of clubs. You can put in your zip code or a city or whatever, and they'll tell you what's in your area. These clubs typically have meetings once a month. And you can drive there, let them know you're coming if you want. You don't have to. But you can show up, and if they have a star party where people show up with telescopes, you can actually go out there and see all the different types of telescopes and figure out which one does what you like. And that's the best way. It's like test driving a car. That's the best way to get out there and figure out what kind of scope you want.
So there are three types, generally speaking, three types of telescopes out there, correct? Well, for the consumer grade, we're not, you know, astronomers or anything. There's like reflective?
Yeah.
A reflector? How does it... Okay, I can't remember.
I'm just going to let you go. Keep going.
Yeah, I'm trying here. You know, come on. I English major, you know, trying to talk about telescopes here.
Well, the words are in English. Come on.
Well, okay, reflector.
Yes.
Another one's Newtonian? Is that another type?
Yeah. There are two basic types. One has a mirror. And it's called a reflector, right? Because
it
reflects.
There's
light.
The reflector. Yep.
The other ones have a lens.
Yeah.
And that's called a refractor.
Refractor. Is that the Newtonian?
They bend light. No, that's different.
Oh.
Refractor was the kind that Galileo had. He didn't invent the telescope, but he used it, and that had a lens on it, and so that's called a refractor. Then, 100 years later, whatever, something like that. I guess it was less. Newton came along, and designed a telescope which used a mirror to reflect light. And so that's called a reflector or a Newtonian telescope. So Newtonians use mirrors. And then you can kind of say, well, there's a subclass that have lenses and mirrors. Those tend to be pretty expensive and difficult to use. They're for people who are really serious about this. But there are a lot of subtypes. Refractors, which use lenses, typically that's when you think of a telescope, that's what you see. Right? It's a big long tube with a lens at one end, and you look through the skinny end. Those tend to be cheaper. They're easier to make. And those are better for looking at things like the moon and the planets. They magnify the image a lot. They're not usually so good for looking at other things like nebulae, gas clouds, and galaxies and such. A mirror is better for those because you can make mirrors bigger than lenses. A mirror is, you only have to polish one side of it, right? And a lens, you have to polish both. So it's easier to make a mirror, and Newton figured that out. And that's the kind I have. It's a 12-inch mirror. It's pretty big. Well, it turns out that these types of telescopes, they get big fast, and they're heavy and hard to use. And so a while back, a San Francisco guy named John Dobson figured out a way, basically, of making an inexpensive Newtonian telescope, and that's now called a Dobsonian telescope. It's still a reflector. It's just cheaper and easier to make and easier to use, and that's the kind I have, actually. It's basically a tube that sits in a box. If you're a do-it-yourselfer, these things are pretty easy to make, and now you can just buy them. They're cheap. You could spend $2,000-$3,000, as I'm sure you're aware, on a telescope. Matter of fact, we just spent like $30,000 on one for my university. But that has a dome, and you can operate it through the web and all kinds of stuff. But, you know, for $300, you can buy a relatively decent Dobsonian telescope and just pull it out whenever, you know, you want to look at the moon or whatever. It's pretty cool.
Now, what I know in the class that I was looking at, they had certain features like not exactly auto alignment, but easier calibration, GPS, so that you don't have to worry about coordinates and the height.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, to me, that's good for me because, you know, I remember geometry and right angles, and I'm just kind of obtuse when it comes to that stuff.
But I'm bummed.
Yeah, well.
But you're a cute guy.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
You're rarely right.
Yeah, I know. Well,
I can go on. I got a lot of these.
All things equilateral, we have to move forward, Phil.
Yeah, we're going off on a tangent.
Right. Oh, God. I think that's a sign. Okay, so we have to was that too obscure?
No, I don't think so.
The one I was looking it's got a Schmidt
Cassegrain. What were we talking about a minute ago?
Telescopes, mirrors,
telescopes,
and stuff like
yes.
that.
No, you were talking about automatic telescopes. This is cool.
Well, I agree, but I have a question on how this term fits into these ranges before we talk about some of these features that I found. Schmidt Cassegrain, is that?
That's just another flavor, like a Newtonian.
Okay, so it is like a Newtonian.
Yeah, there's. Basically, a Newtonian is very long. You've got a mirror at one end, what's called the primary mirror. And it's shaped like a parabola. So when light hits it, the light is bent. It's reflected to a point. And then at that point, you have another mirror, a flat mirror, which reflects that light into an eyepiece. So you've got two mirrors, a curved one and a flat one, and an eyepiece. The Schmidt-Cassegrains are more complicated. You've got a primary mirror that reflects light to another mirror, which is also curved, which then reflects that light through a hole in the primary mirror into your eyepiece, and you can have more mirrors and all. It gets very complicated very quickly. A Schmidt-Cassegrain is nice because it's not as long. A Newtonian telescope, my 12-inch telescope is about 6 feet long.
Wow.
A Schmidt-Cassegrain that's 12-inch might only be 2 feet long. It's much smaller, more compact. But they tend to be a lot more expensive because the mirrors involved have to be a little bit more precise and they're harder to grind. So, you know, it just depends on what you're looking for. My Newtonian is my Dobsonian, actually, which is the same as a Newton, but it's just a tube in a box. It comes in two pieces. The box doesn't weigh much. The tube is kind of heavy because the mirror's big. But it's sitting in my garage. I can say, you know what, I want to go outside and look at the Orion Nebula. And 5 minutes later, I'm looking at the Orion Nebula. If I had a Schmidt-Cassegrain sitting in my garage, a half an hour later, I'll be looking at the Orion Nebula because I've got to pull the tripod out. And I got to put the mount on, then I got to put the telescope on the mount, and then I got to align it, and I got to do this, and I got to do that. If you have it sitting outside all the time, that's a powerful instrument. The real difference is that with a Dobsonian like mine, I have to guide it by hand, right? The stars are rising and setting. As the Earth spins, the stars rise and the stars set. And when you magnify the image of a planet or a star or whatever, it's going to go moving through your eyepiece really quickly. With my Dobsonian, I have to sit there by hand and move it to center up an object again if I want to look at it. The better solution to something like this is like with these more fancy telescopes. They have equipment on them, gears, like a clock. It's even called a clock drive that moves your telescope to track the stars. So that was a big innovation when it was invented, and it became cheaper about 30 years ago. Now it's hard to buy a telescope without them.
Yeah.
The big innovation now is that you can set up your telescope and line it up with a couple of stars, tell the telescope, literally there's a computer on the telescope, you tell the telescope, okay, now I'm looking at Vega, now I'm looking at Rigel, now I'm looking at whatever, and it figures out exactly where the telescope is pointed, maps that onto the sky, and then you say, show me the Andromeda Galaxy, and it goes, and moves to the Andromeda Galaxy, and there it is in your eyepiece. It's very slick. I like these. It makes finding stuff a lot easier. And a lot of really diehard astronomers, amateur astronomers, don't like these. They say, oh, the point of astronomy is finding the object. And I think, no. The point of astronomy is seeing the object.
I agree.
If you can't find it, you cannot see it. And I'll tell you, most telescopes that get bought for Christmas and for gifts or birthdays or whatever don't get used because people set them up and they find out this is not easy. This is hard to do at first. It's a steep learning curve.
Well, that's one of the reasons why the hardware that I was looking for had those features. Like, they take it a step further, and maybe this is the GPS thing that you were referring to. You point it at a star and say what you're looking at. My issue is I don't necessarily know what I'm looking at.
Right.
So, I mean, that looks yellow.
Look, I don't either. Mm-hmm. I look at something and say, hey, what the heck is that?
That looks like Polaris to me.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, and that's great. I mean, a lot of these, you can set them up. You point the telescope at Polaris, which is really not that hard to do, and then you tell it what time it is, and if it has a GPS and it knows its location, because your longitude is important too, where you are on the Earth, it'll figure out where it's pointed, and then bang, done. And it's usually good enough for use out in your yard. In fact, we have a robotic telescope, like I was talking about earlier, for my university, and we actually have it aligned really even better than that, so that we can actually tell it to point to a galaxy, and when it finds it, the galaxy is really well centered, and then we can set it up to do all this automatically. This is sort of the ultimate telescope. It's sitting in a dome at a remote location. It's operable through the web, and I can command it to say, observe this galaxy, take this many images using these filters, and when you're done with the data, email it to me. So I can sit around in my PJs waiting all night, and then, or you know, I can go. I literally did this. I watched, I think it was Dodgeball, while the telescope was taking its pictures, and then I came back after the movie was over, and the good guys won, and Ben Stiller was vanquished, and there was my data, and I could analyze it scientifically. It's very, very cool.
High resolution images?
Oh yeah, this is a professional quality instrument. This is a 14-inch telescope. It's not that big. It's the kind that, you know, if you have a little bit of cash lying around, you could buy. You know, it's like a $2,000 or $3,000 telescope. The problem is the mount is robotic. The mount is what's very expensive, and that costs you, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 in many cases. But they're going to get cheaper. This is a very precise mount for scientific purposes. For what, you know, you or I might want to use just to go out and kick around in the backyard, you don't need anything like that. And so this stuff is getting cheaper. It's pretty amazing.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I think Ponzi decided that we could get a telescope. The issue is getting a telescope in Seattle in the middle of winter isn't exactly a bright idea.
Well, you can read the instructions many times.
Exactly.
It clears up, yeah.
I can watch the clouds. Like, you wouldn't. I mean, the detail of the water droplets, you know, at 30,000 feet are astounding.
Haven't you guys had like a month of rain in January and December, something like that?
Pretty much. It didn't rain yesterday. It's a little overcast today. What are you going to do?
I mean, it depends on where you live. If you live in New Mexico or Arizona, you're all set. Where I was a kid, you know, you never knew what on the East Coast if it was going to be cloudy or rainy. Where I live now in Northern California, it stops raining in April, and I'm good for 6, 7, 8 months. And, you know, basically any night I want to observe, I can. It's really excellent. So, you know, you have to think about that, too. If you're buying a telescope, do you live in a place where it's really useful for you to have one? There are telescopes you can use online to get data, but they're not very much fun, to be honest.
I don't know if I could do that.
It's like, oh, I want to get a picture of the Ring Nebula, which is this really pretty object in the sky up in the summer. You can send a note to that telescope, and then a couple of days later it sends you a horribly compressed black and white JPEG. It's like, golly, thank you. You know, I could have gone online and downloaded the Hubble Space Telescope image of this, and it would have been cooler. The part about astronomy, the reason you buy a telescope is to go outside and see this stuff. It's to be there. It's to see, you know, here's a photon, a particle of light that's been traveling for 3 million years from the Andromeda Galaxy. You know, the most complicated simian creature on the Earth was, you know, Australopithecus afarensis. And that photon has been traveling since that animal was walking the Earth. And, it, you know, that light has now hit my eye and I'm seeing it. That's part of the cool factor. And it's hard to deny. There is a huge cool factor in this. It takes a little while. It takes practice. It's like doing anything in life. It's not always easy to start with, but the rewards are huge, just huge.
Does it get easier, that learning curve, with more expensive amateur telescopes?
Oh, yeah. When I was a TA at when I was in grad school, and we ran a class that used telescopes like this, and there was one object that the students always had a hard time finding. and they'd come to me and complain, Mr. Plant, I can't find M3. And I'd say, well, let me take a look. And I'd grab the telescope, and 3 seconds later, bang, there it was. And I'd show it to him through the eyepiece. They'd say, how do you do that? And I'd unlock the telescope and move it at random and say, I don't know, but it's your turn now. And they hated me. But the point was I was showing them that it can be done. And I would in fact tell them, you know, you see that bright star, start there and do this and do that, you can find it. But yeah, it gets pretty easy after you do it for a little while, and it's just so much fun to see stuff. Sometimes you just look at it and think, oh, that looks like a Q-tip looked through a lens smeared with Vaseline, you know, no big deal. Then other times you'll see something like a globular cluster, which is a cluster of stars, millions and millions of stars packed together into a ball a few light years across, and it looks like a beehive. And if you look at that through a big telescope and you see all those stars, they're really beautiful. It's amazing what you can see with your own eyes. It's really just an incredible way of spending an evening.
Have you ever discovered any objects that no one else discovered?
Not really. I used Hubble for a long time, and you would stumble across interesting aspects of things that weren't known before, of objects that we did know about. I found a nebula in another galaxy that I was hoping hadn't been discovered yet. It turns out it had been observed before, but it was only just in a catalog. They noted its position and how bright it was. With our data, we could actually analyze it and find out some of its chemical content and do a little bit of physical analysis of it. So that was actually really cool. There's a real sense of, you know, I'm doing something that nobody's ever done before. We're using this new tool, which has opened up a whole new vista on the universe, and we're seeing things that we've either never seen before or seeing things we've known about much better than we've ever seen them before. And that's fantastic. It's such a great feeling.
Seems like planetary exploration, I mean, through the telescope, seems to be becoming a hot topic, it seems. Every other month I hear, we've discovered a new planet around this particular star or whatever, even though they haven't really seen the planet. They're just, you know, going by mathematical data and the way things look.
Right.
And I think it's interesting. Are we getting closer to, I don't know. I want to bring up the movie Contact. You know, first of all, because I want to see what you thought. And second of all, I mean, is that potentially realistic? Are we starting to look at a lot more planets than just those in our solar system in the hopes that we're going to find something?
Yeah, this is well, you know, Contact was science fiction, aliens sending out a radio signal. It's based on pretty good logical premise that if aliens wanted to contact people, then radio waves are a pretty good way to do it. They're simple to receive and simple to interpret. And so in Contact, basically our own radio signals from the 1930s and 40s were emitted into space, and a receiver by an alien a few light years away picked it up and then sent us a signal using radio waves. And then we built this machine that took us to them, or at least Jodie Foster. But I enjoyed that movie quite a bit. It portrays astronomers pretty realistically. There are good guys and bad guys. There are geeks and people who aren't geeks. I don't know of any astronomers personally who would be able to score with Matthew McConaughey, although I'm sure a lot of them would like to try. In fact, one or two might have a shot. But and the fact that it was Jodie Foster actually kind of funny. But you know what, don't use that in the interview. I'll have a lot of friends of mine who are angry at me for saying something stupid like that. But there you go. If I can't say something stupid, I wouldn't be me. So the premise of science fiction, are aliens out there trying to contact us? Who knows? But when I was a kid, you know, up until the 1990s even, we didn't know of any planets orbiting other stars. The nine orbiting the sun, if you consider Pluto a planet, the nine orbiting the sun, that's it. That's all we knew about. We assumed, we hoped, that, you know, our sun isn't that special and there are other planets orbiting other stars. And it wasn't until the 90s that they started becoming discovered. And now there are, you know, I don't even know what the most recent number is. It's so hard to keep track. There are at least 120 planets orbiting other stars, some of which are part of multiple systems, where they know there are three planets orbiting a star, for example. And you can determine this by looking very, very carefully at the star's spectrum. As a planet orbits the star, it tugs on the star.
Sometimes the wobble.
Star is moving towards us and sometimes moving away from us, and that puts a Doppler shift in the spectrum, the same thing that makes a car go when it goes past you. It's exactly the same phenomenon. And you can see that in a star spectrum, and you can determine a lot about the planet that way. And then last year, a planet was actually seen for the first time. And it
really?
Looks like it is, in fact, a planet that they were able to image.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I have it in my blog. If you go to badastronomy.com and then click on my blog and search for extrasolar planet, you'll find that entry. And it's not a planet anything like the Earth. It's orbiting a much smaller star than the Sun. It's a much younger star. The planet's very hot. So it's a very young thing, and it's different, but it does look like it is a planetary massed object, and it was seen. And NASA certainly thinks that we can image planets like the Earth orbiting other stars so much that one of their funding priorities is a project called the Terrestrial Planet Finder, or TPF. And that is specifically built to look for Earths around other stars. We think they're out there. As far as the scientists who use math and physics to model this type of thing go, it's not that hard to form planets like Earth around other stars. And the observers are finding planets around other stars. They're not like our solar system. They're not like our planet. But we see them, which means planets do form. So now things are a lot different than they were when I was a kid. We think there might be lots of planets out there, billions of them in our galaxy alone.
Do you think with telescopes either today or with this new TPF project, are we going to see, I mean potentially, are we going to see anything that might be construed as extraterrestrial?
You mean alien?
Yeah, sure. Are we going to see evidence of civilization? Potentially. I mean, are the telescopes powerful? Are the telescopes powerful enough to pick up on things that might be on the planet, around the planet?
Well, you have to be clever. I love doing this kind of speculation. It's a little bit fun. If we were to look at a planet orbiting Alpha Centauri, the nearest star system to the Sun, and we find an Earth-like planet, we could actually, with TPF, and there's another mission called the Space Interferometry Mission, or SIM, which will do something similar. It might be possible to actually image the planet and actually be able to get a spectrum of it. And when you get a spectrum of it, you can figure out what chemical contents are in it. For the Earth, if you were to take a spectrum of the Earth, you would see indications of oxygen, O2, in our atmosphere. And the thing about O2 is it's very reactive chemically. It combines with stuff very easily. So if something were to happen to create a lot of oxygen, within a few decades it would go away. It would all combine to form other chemicals. So for there to be oxygen in our atmosphere, there has to be a source of it. The most obvious source is life, plant life, creating oxygen. So if we see a chemical signature of O2 in a planet orbiting some other star, that's an indication of life. Now, it's not an indication of intelligent life, of civilization, but, you know, one step at a time. First, let's find the planet, then let's look for the chemical signatures, and then we'll think about life. But there are people who love to speculate about this stuff, and one guy said, if you wanted to make your presence known, one thing you could do is take an element like, say, technetium, which is an unstable radioactive element, and there are ways of creating it, for example, I think, in nuclear power plants. It's sort of a waste product. If you were to make several hundred tons of this stuff, which is, you know, a lot, and dump it into your star, so if we were to make, like, a million tons of technetium, dump them into the Sun, somebody observing the Sun would be able to see that. They'd see that in the spectrum of the Sun, and they'd say, gosh, why is there a short-lived radioactive element coming from this star? The only way it can be made is through, you know, artificial nuclear processes, which means there must be a civilization around that star. This may be ridiculous, this particular idea, but the point is, if you want your presence to be known, there are ways to do it. It might cost you a fortune in time, energy, and money, but it's possible. So who knows what we'll see when we really start looking.
Isn't that kind of dangerous, you know, throwing stuff into the Sun?
It's really hard. People think you just get it up into space and let it fall in, but it's not true. The Earth is moving around the Sun at 30 kilometers a second, you know, 18 miles per second. So you have to give your rocket that much speed so it can drop into the Sun, and that's hard to do. But one assumes that if you're advanced enough and you wanna be known, there may be other ways of doing this. I don't know. You know, I'm not an alien, and nobody's paying me to think about stuff like this. But it's weird. In the scientific journals, there are people who are writing serious scientific papers about stuff like this. That maybe there's the signature of an intelligent civilization, maybe even a hugely advanced one, out in space. You just have to look for it.
Yeah, but if we don't know what we're looking for, it's kind of difficult.
Well, you don't know what you're looking for. On the other hand, if a civilization says, I want emerging technological civilizations to be able to find us, to see that we're out here, then you're going to make it easy. If you're trying to communicate with somebody who doesn't speak English, you know, you might come up with a simple code to represent words, like Morse code, or, well, Morse code represents English, but just something like that. You want to make it as simple as possible. So a civilization who's trying to make themselves known won't make it that hard for somebody like us to figure that out. And that's sort of the first assumption these people make. And so if you assume that they're making it easy, then you look for easy stuff. You look for stars whose chemical balance is way out of whack. You look for giant structures in space. You look for things like prime numbers, where prime numbers don't seem to come up naturally in the universe. So if you find some signal that's built up out of prime numbers or something like that, that might indicate there's somebody out there trying to talk to you.
Do you think we've been visited? Do you think they know about us? If there is anybody out there, do you think? Just curious.
People ask me this a lot. Usually I get a kid after I give a public talk, and they say, do you believe in aliens, and do you think they visited us? And I say, yes and no. I think that the universe is very big, and there sure seems to be a lot of evidence that there are lots of planets out there. So I think that it seems almost inevitable that there are other forms of life out there. Whether they're intelligent or not, that's an interesting question, but there's probably other life out there.
Well, someone would probably argue that it's questionable whether or not there's intelligent life on this planet.
Well, that's true. Well, there's always dolphins. Right.
Not true.
And women.
So long, and thanks for the fish.
Yeah. But if you postulate that there's intelligence out there, are they visiting us? Well, I can argue mathematically that it wouldn't take too long for us in a universal timescale to colonize the entire Milky Way galaxy, probably a few million years. That's a long time. But the galaxy is billions of years old, and so a million years and that much, you know, that sort of length isn't that much. So could aliens have colonized the galaxy? Could they be visiting us? Maybe. But the question is, are they here now? And this pertains to UFOs. I have not seen a single piece of evidence. And people constantly say, there's tons of evidence. And they show it to me, and I think, this isn't evidence. This is anecdotes. This is people who've seen lights in the sky. These may be reliable people. But that doesn't mean that what they're seeing is really a flying saucer, if you want to call it that, a spaceship.
Do you think that that's political in the sense that, you know, number one, to say that you've seen something, you'd be called a wacko, number one.
If I were to see something that I thought were an actual intelligently piloted spaceship, I would be on my rooftop shouting about it. Have no doubt about this. This would be the biggest thing ever, ever, ever. And, you know, I've seen stuff in the sky I can't explain, but that doesn't mean they're flying saucers. I've seen stuff that could be, you know, I saw a rocket reenter once, meteors. I saw a flock of birds once lit underneath by a spotlight. My gosh, that had me going for a minute from a long way off. I actually wrote about that. I've written about that a couple of times. It was really funny standing there thinking, what am I seeing? What am I seeing? And I'm hearing this weird noise, and then I hear this, and I thought, oh, it's geese. Great. Okay. And that was at a space shuttle launch. It was the one space shuttle launch I've seen. So you want to talk about having this happen at, like, the most scientifically grounded place on Earth to be wondering about UFOs for a second. But the thing is, you know, I just don't see any evidence of aliens visiting us now. Aliens out there, maybe they visited us a million years ago, maybe a billion years ago. I just don't see any evidence of it now. If they're out here now, they're doing a pretty good job of hiding it.
Well, that's what when I say political. You know, think about what would happen if we were to discover. Number one, you know, they've probably seen how we treat each other, and I think that would probably stop them from wanting to even, you know.
Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be a big reason why. I mean, I'm not an alien, but if I was an alien and I was thinking, you know, who could I visit today? It wouldn't be the people who treat each other the way that we treat each other.
Well, maybe. I mean,
politically speaking.
Look at the Christian missionaries in Africa. They see people who are starving or people who are, you know, dying of disease, and they go there to help because they've got this huge impulse to help. Maybe aliens are like that. Maybe they want to help. Maybe they'd say, gosh, we better intervene here because these guys are going to blow themselves up.
Seriously, if aliens were to come and say, yo, hey, we're here now, or, you know, some way, you know, communicate with us, everyone, I swear to God, everyone would freak out. I mean, it would be pandemonium on a global scale.
I think that actually might cause World War III.
Right. Religions would implode. You know, political. I mean, yeah, it would. It would be just chaos. And I think that would be the reason why. I mean, to argue the other side, if they have visited us, that's probably one of the primary reasons they have not been as. I think they've been. If.
What was that word? I'm sorry, I missed.
If
I'm hearing a wind in my ear here.
They have been here. They maybe just be testing the waters. I certainly wouldn't expect anything to show itself because of the pandemonium that would ensue.
Well, the thing
guaranteed.
Is, Larry Niven, the science fiction author, and I don't think this originated with him, but he says this a lot. He says the thing about aliens is they're alien. We don't know what their motivations are. I can think of several motivations for aliens to come here. There's the to serve man theory, that they're here to eat us. The old Twilight Zone episode, which is based on a classic science fiction episode, that you know that we thought the aliens were here to help us, to serve us, but in fact it's a cookbook, right? To serve man. Maybe aliens would come here because they're like the best of us. They want to explore. They want to understand. So they go out and meet new life forms and new civilizations, and hope that by meeting new people, they can see themselves for the first time, to understand themselves better, to understand the universe better. Maybe, you know, people say, oh, if, you know, this was sort of the early 20th century idea that aliens would have to be peaceful because to be able to travel to the stars, they would need a global civilization. They would have had to make peace and all that. It's like, I don't think so. Look at us. I mean, Americans are arguably, I mean, you could argue against it, but it's arguably, we're the most technologically advanced civilization on this planet. And yes, we're so friendly and helpful and warm to everybody, you know. We're not far from developing technology to get us to the nearby stars. You could actually build a rocket to do it now, although, you know, life support systems would be tough. But the propulsion system is there. It's primitive. You wind up throwing atomic bombs in the back of your ship and the blast propels you. So it's kind of a brute force method, but it works. So we could start civilizing other, you know, exploring other planets. And we are still a very warlike race. So I don't believe that aliens exploring the galaxy need to be peaceful. And in fact, you can imagine that war drives technology. So the best warriors are the ones who might have the best civilization. They might be the ones who subjugate the rest of the planet and then use that technology to go to other planets to subjugate them as well. So I can argue either way, and probably the best thing that people say is, chances are the first alien we meet is going to be a robot. We've already sent machines out of the solar system, Voyager 1 and 2 and Pioneer 10 and 11, and New Horizons launches in a couple of days to go to Pluto. That's going out of the solar system too, and it's going to be the fastest of everything we've sent. So, you know, those are our Lewis and Clark machines now. They're the robots. So, and it's the best and cheapest way to explore the galaxy. So chances are, if an alien probe does come, it'll be automated. And it may be so sophisticated, it may seem like it's alive. But, you know, it may still just be a machine.
And it may burn up in the atmosphere. Or maybe it already has.
Well, probably the thing, you know, the best way to do it is to send it by the star that you know has planets. We know we can look for Earth-like planets around other stars. You can target solar systems like ours. It can swing by the planets, and even from far out, it can look for signs of life. And if it detects them, maybe there's some way it could slow down, swing really close into the star, for example, use magnetic fields to collect hydrogen and then fuse them like a fusion rocket to slow down, and then swing by the Earth and communicate with us. Ah, you know, just making this stuff up.
I realize I'm kind of stretching your abilities here.
Oh, I don't know.
I'm not?
This is kind of fun. I like using my imagination.
So you think that's imagination or science?
Well, that isn't science imagination. You have, I mean, science, people, I hate this. People always talk about scientists like they're cold, stodgy, passionless people.
Well,
like Shakespeare
case in
has
point.
This imagination. But, you know, Shakespeare had a formula that he used. You have a play in X number of acts. Look at a sonnet. A sonnet has to have a certain number of lines, a rhyming scheme, a certain number of syllables. And that's like a scientific law that you have to obey. But what you put in there is solely up to your imagination. The universe runs by a set of rules, a set of laws, and we understand a lot of these laws. But certain things do happen. We're not totally unstrained, unrestrained, that we can just imagine anything. But by using our imagination, we can try to fill in those laws and see what happens with them. Most scientists are incredibly imaginative because they have to come up with this weird crap to figure out what's going on. So there.
I stand corrected.
I get a little passionate.
A little emotional.
Kind of stuff, yeah.
I don't know. You're uncaring. You're just saying you're hiding behind your numbers there.
And, you know, of all of the misconceptions I deal with, that's the one that irritates me the most. These people come in and say, oh, these government scientists, they're just drones, sit at their computers. And it's like, you really need to go to some of these astronomy meetings I go to, where we are, you know, arguing with each other and laughing and you know, we have a great time. I just, at this meeting I went to, we ended up at a nightclub dancing until 2 a.m. I mean, this is astronomy. We're people, right?
Now, wait. Now, if there's something called bad astronomy, I think that was just it.
Yeah, I've got some pictures of that night, too. Only one of me, thank heavens. Yeah. But there you go. I mean, the point is that we're people, and we have, you know, we have lives, we have emotions, and a good scientist understands all that. I do not discount my emotions when I make a decision. I'm not, you know, Mr. Spock. I'm not a machine. I'm a human being.
Okay, Dr. Phil, what was the latest thing you debunked?
What is the latest thing I debunked? Probably that chaos cloud.
Yeah.
The idea that there's a giant cloud of radiation coming from the center of the galaxy that's going to envelope the Earth. That was the latest thing I've debunked. But that's, you know, there's always more moon hoax stuff. There's always more face on Mars stuff. I am now starting to take on creationism. I'm giving a talk in Las Vegas at the end of January at James Randi's The Amazing Meeting about this, and I'm on a panel at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is a huge science organization. I'm on a panel about the current attack on science. A lot of this stuff, you asked me earlier, you know, what's the big deal about this, and I said we're eroding our ability to think critically. A lot of this stuff, that's exactly what's going on. The problem is you've got fundamental religious people who are attacking science, and they are able to sway people who are not fundamentally religious. There are many people who think evolution is wrong who are just, you know, your average person. And the problem is that's not correct. The arguments against evolution are incorrect. Evolution is correct. Evolution works. But there are people out there who think it's not. And that's where the danger is, that, you know, those of us who live in the reality-based community where things actually happen are losing to people who live in a fantasy, because the people who live in a fantasy can sell it, and people are buying it. And so that's where the danger is. We have the Constitution of the United States of America, one of the most important documents ever written, is under attack by these people, and they're getting a toehold in it because they are able to misuse science. And so I think that this may be the most important thing I've ever done besides becoming a father, and that is to protect the Constitution, to protect reality, to protect science from these attackers. And so that may be the next step in my own evolution, is to proactively go out and fight this stuff.
Is that the Skeptics Conference that you're going to, or is that another
one? James Randi's a skeptic. He's been around forever. Do you know he was on he was on Happy Days?
Really?
He played a magician on Happy Days, and he accidentally drank a glass of vodka when he thought it was water, and Fonzie has to do the trick. Like, wow, Randi was on Happy Days. I guess that's cool. It was before they jumped the shark, so that's cool.
Hey, that's kind of scary that you knew that.
But I do that a lot. I go to these conferences, skeptic conferences, astronomy conferences, and talk about this kind of stuff.
Can you prove it?
No. Oh. Yes, I have photographic evidence.
No,
and the shadows are not parallel in the picture, so maybe it was all fake.
See, that's what I'm saying. That's what gets me a little concerned. Hey, what do you think about Penn and Teller, their show, BS?
I was on it.
That's right, you were.
So, no, I wasn't. I caught you. Oh. You don't watch the show.
Yeah, I do.
Nuts. Yeah, I was on it. I was on a Moon Hoax episode, actually.
That's when I freaked out. I'm like, I know that guy. No, what do you think about Penn and Teller?
It was very cool to meet them for the first time at Randi's meeting. They actually sponsor Randi's meeting, and so they're there, and that was a riot. I think the surprising thing is that Teller is the same height I am. I'm 5'10". Penn is enormous!
Holy cow!
He's a giant!
He must be.
He's like 6'17". I mean, he's just so tall. So I just think that's funny, you know, because they always talk about the little guy, and it's like, he's not little. He's actually just about average height. I think they're a lot of fun. Penn and I were on a panel together, and I disagreed with attitudes about skepticism. But, you know, his persona is to be obnoxious and in your face, and that's not really, I'm not in your face, I may be obnoxious, but, you know, there are different methods for doing this, and that's fine. The TV show itself, I first caught it, I don't get Showtime, so I caught it when I was on travel, and I saw it, I just laughed myself silly.
Oh yeah, it's a great show.
The episode about bottled water nearly gave me a heart attack, I was laughing so hard.
Yeah.
And so when they said, you know, and I actually recommended they do a moon hoax show, which they promptly forgot. And then they did a, you know, they forgot I'd mentioned it. It was no big deal. They probably have 8 million people emailing them all the time. But then a year later, they contacted me, their producer did, and said, we're doing a conspiracy theory show about JFK and the moon hoax. And so I said, sure, I'll be on it. And that was fun. And, you know, I'd love to see them do more. There's plenty more that could be done, like astrology and different topics. And those may be, you know,
they've touched upon them. Yeah, they've touched upon a few of those.
And it's a fairly well done show. They I can't vouch for how accurate it is because they do a lot of topics that I don't follow. I don't know enough about, you know, I don't know, homeopathy, for example, to argue against it. I know some basics of why homeopathy doesn't work, but you'd need to talk to an expert to see if the debunking that Penn and Teller did was right. But they do a huge amount of research, and Penn made a point specifically. He said, if you find mistakes in our show, let us know, and we will, you know, revisit this. And, you know, they've had a lot of people complain about a lot of their stuff. One guy, I remember, at a meeting specifically was targeting their secondhand smoke episode. And they said, we researched this, and if you think secondhand smoke has long-term physical effects, let us know. And the guy wound up backing down, saying that the papers he read, don't show permanent effects of secondhand smoke. I think that's how that went. But, you know, it's like that. They're actually trying to be as transparent and as accurate as they can be. So I'm really pleased with this.
And it's a very entertaining show. Probably.
Yeah, they're funny.
Yeah, one of the best produced. Showtime is quickly becoming one of my favorite premium channels because allegedly they're going to be picking up Arrested Development, I've heard.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that's one of my favorite shows that's on. Well, going to be on for just a little while longer. And they may be picking it up after Fox is being stupid and dropping it, which will probably make the show better.
Fox is unbelievable. They dropped
Family Guy,
Futurama, Family Guy, yeah, and then Firefly. And I had so many people saying, you got to watch Firefly. So I finally watched it, and I thought, wow, show rocks.
I don't know. I didn't get into Firefly, and now I'm kind of glad I didn't, because then I couldn't have gotten into it. Well, I mean,
because
it's not around anymore.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I hate
it. It's
kind
of sad, actually. Watching it, and you know it's only like 13 episodes, kind of sucks. So, yeah, I like Penn & Teller's show. I wish there were more debunking shows, because, man, I'll tell you, you look at TV shows like History Channel, Learning Channel, and the Pet Psychic, Animal Planet's owned by the Discovery Channel family, I think, and they have a show called Pet Psychic? That's wrong on so many levels, I can't even stand it. And yet, you know, there it is.
So wait, are you saying that the History Channel and the Learning Channel and maybe even the Science Channel or the Discovery ilk don't always produce correct, I guess, arguments or statements?
I will say that the Science Channel, as far as I can see, has always had good, solid science shows. I love Tuesday night. It's Space Night on there. They have Cosmos and documentaries and stuff. And it's a lot of fun.
The reruns with
I watch it with
Sagan.
Yeah, exactly. I watch it with my daughter. She loves it. But, you know, History Channel has, you know, haunted mansions, haunted ships. Learning Channel has all kinds of stuff like that as well, UFOs and ghosts and things. And the thing is, you know, look, if you want to tackle UFOs, that's fine. But to sit there and gullibly show every blurred light in the sky and say, is this a flying saucer? You know, every psychic who walks through an old mansion and says, oh, there's a cold spot there. Yes, it's a 150-year-old mansion, you know. There are going to be cold spots in it and bad wiring so that you get electromagnetic flux and all kinds of stuff. It's just ridiculous the way they handle this stuff. They go in with the attitude that they're going to sell the paranormal because people want to hear about it. They're not going in there to say, we want to find out what's really going on. That's why I like the Penn & Teller show. That's why I like Michael Shermer's show, the guy who runs Skeptic. Exploring the Unknown, I think is what it was called. I may be getting that name wrong. There have been shows that have done good critical thinking analyses of these types of phenomena. But and sometimes they do well. Look at Penn & Teller show. It's doing very well. It's in its third season. Truth can sell. you don't have to pimp it up necessarily.
Yeah, but
like you do with the UFO stuff.
You kind of claim that you're not making a lot of money. So really, how valuable is the truth?
I could be making more money. I'm trying to make more money. I'd love to be self-sufficient. I mean, look, I'm human. I need money. I live in Northern California. My mortgage is obscene. I need scientific notation to write down my mortgage. I'd love to make more money. I'd love to sell more books and all that to support myself doing this because you know, I love money. I want to take a, you know, sit in a bathtub full of dollar bills and rub them all over my face. But also because it's an indication of how well you're doing. If people are buying your product, that means that you are doing a good job at getting them to buy them. You're selling the product, whatever it is. In my case, you know, I'm selling the truth. I will do this whether I'm making money at it or not. If I can make money at it, I will. But if I can't, I will still do this. You know, I ran this website at a loss for 10 years, because not because I was trying to make money at it, because I'm trying to explain what's really going on. You see, science is the best thing we've got going to understand how the universe works. We investigate things. If you see something, it's like, I wonder why that happened. And we try not to let our preconceived notions sway us. Now, of course, that's going to happen. Everybody has preconceptions. But hopefully a scientific preconception is based on reality. I have seen this phenomenon happen before. Therefore, if I see something different, is it related? How do these things go together? What's going on? And when you see something that doesn't work, if I see a phenomenon and I say, golly, this does not fit the model I have, you know, and my observations are good observations, my model must be wrong. And I adapt my model to that. And this way you incrementally approach reality.
Who do you use as your model? Kate Moss? Cindy Crawford?
Ew, Kate Moss, she's yucky.
She's yucky? What?
She's so skinny.
Yeah, I agree. She is.
That whole heroin chic thing.
She's an alien, by the way. I read that in the... Yeah, in the Star.
Has Scarlett Johansson ever been a model?
No,
she's
going
to be a model, right? She's going to do, like, some makeup thing. She'd be okay. She's okay looking at me.
Are those good scientific models?
Yes.
Are those the best scientific models?
Well, haven't you seen the Britney Spears quantum mechanics website?
I think I have.
Yeah, that was out there a long time ago. Britney Spears describes.
You know, I can tell you that the most entertaining piece of science that I've ever heard came from M.C. Hawking.
M.C. Hawking.
That's right.
Most people are aware of Stephen Hawking's career as a physicist, but are not aware of his gangster rap of history.
Yeah, it's an amazing.
If you're listening to this right now and you have not looked up M.C. Hawking,
you have to
go.
It's so funny.
If you're a scientist, that is the funniest thing on the entire internet.
What does Hawking think about it? Do you know?
I heard that he had heard about it and thought it was funny. Look, here's a guy who was in California for a meeting, is a big Star Trek: The Next Generation fan, so they wrote him into a script. He was actually on Next Generation.
Yeah, I remember they were playing cards.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
at the beginning.
Einstein.
Yep.
And he, you know, he was on The Simpsons. I think they used his voice.
Wow.
When he had the, he had invented the exoskeleton and could fly around. I can't remember that whole episode. But you know, there you go. The guy's got a sense of humor. And so I don't know if he likes M.C. Hawking or not, but oh my gosh, is that funny stuff.
You down with entropy?
I could say what he says about the creationists, but I can't.
Oh, yeah.
yeah, he says his power is his mass times the speed of light squared. There's some great lyrics in this thing, and he does a Led Zeppelin cover.
Wait, do you think that the person who did M.C. Hawking was really a scientist or really knew what he was talking about?
He seems, you know, I hate to break the fourth wall here, as they say in stage play, but yeah, I think so. He knows enough of this stuff to understand what's happening. And let me see, I gotta find out while I'm sitting here. Led Zeppelin. How do you spell Led Zeppelin? There we go.
Just look up M.C. Hawking. It should pop up right there. I don't think he's done anything lately, though.
No, I haven't seen anything in a long time.
If they release that into a CD, I realize this stuff is for free.
No, he's got a CD.
Is it legit? I mean, I can't tell.
Yeah, I think so. I think you can buy it. Here's one, Crazy As Bad Word, and it's on Fear of a Black Hole. equals M.C. Hawking. But he does Led Zeppelin tribute album in Comium, and it's so funny because you can hear him going, ah, 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 ah.
Oh, yeah.
what is that, Robert Plant? I had to sit down. I was laughing so hard. This stuff is brilliant. These science is funny.
Yeah, apparently it is. More fun than I could shake a stick at.
Yeah.
I don't know. More fun than shooting monkeys in a barrel?
Depends on the vibrational frequency of the stick.
No, that gets back to the hypertrans-dimensional vortexes.
That's right. You faked that stick. You can't shake a stick at something when there's no stick.
Isn't that, there is no spoon? Is that
there
kind of the
no
matrix theory?
I use that a lot. When somebody gives me an idea that doesn't make any sense, I say, there is no spoon.
And they look at you and say, what?
My favorite thing just about ever, ever, ever is in the opening of Ghostbusters, when the three of them go to the New York Public Library to investigate the ghost there, and there's a whole bunch of books stacked up, and Dan Aykroyd goes nuts, and he's running a little machine on it, and he says, this is clear evidence of paranormal activity. And Bill Murray looks at him and says, yes, no human would stack books that way. And that's like my skeptical credo. You know, so always look for a simpler, more logical explanation if you can. Even though in the end it was ghosts who had stacked the books.
Live streaming of The Chris Perillo Show is brought to you by Microsoft Windows Media and Limelight Networks. Download Windows Media Player 10 to listen to The Chris Perillo Show live every Thursday from 6 to 9 p.m. Pacific, GMT-8.